So we didn't quite finish last time. Is that too loud? I hear an echo. Should I turn it down a little? Is it okay? Okay. We didn't quite finish last time. Let me just briefly bring us back to where we were and wrap up the previous discussion. After reviewing this big contrast between two ways to approach the problem of explaining inequality, blaming the victim and blaming society, I made the argument that while there may be some truth in both, really, people's situations vary an awful lot more than their personal attributes, and that if we really want to explain why it is the case that we have such persistent levels of poverty and such very large levels of inequality in the United States, you really have to look at social structures and how they work. What are the social mechanisms that are generating this level of inequality? And that then took us to the latter part of the lecture, where we were exploring three different social structural explanations of inequality and poverty. These are different but not inconsistent. All three, I think, are relevant. Think of these as three different processes through which high levels of inequality and persistent poverty are generated. The first concerns marginalization. That's various processes which have the effect of excluding people from labor markets, pushing them out, making it very difficult for people to get good and stable jobs. And my central point there is, even if it is the case that we observe that people with low skills can't find good jobs because there aren't jobs to be found, it's incorrect really to say, aha, the problem is they don't have enough skills. Of course, that is a problem. But it's just as much a problem that we're not generating the kind of jobs that match the source of people we have. It's a question of the match between the two. And the match can either be attributed to deficits in the persons or deficits in the job structure. And given that there are so many things that need to be done in the society in which we live that actually don't require a lot of skills, and that the problem is that the market simply doesn't produce those jobs, I think it's really a misdescription, a misunderstanding to say the problem lies in the lack of skills, rather than the problem lies in the fact that we don't generate the sorts of jobs that are adequate for the distribution of skill levels that we have in the economy. Okay, that was the first, that's the issue of marginalization, people pushed out of the labor market. The second issue was inequalities within labor markets. So now we are looking at that part of the population, of the working age population, that actually gets into the labor market. And we're trying to understand, why is it that the wage distribution among the available jobs in which people find themselves is so unequal? These are among people who actually get into the labor market. There are two possible ways of organizing the way in which wages get connected to jobs. Now, that's not typically the way people think about it. Economists like to think about the way wages get connected to people. But when you actually give it any serious thought, it's pretty obvious that there's two things going on. Earnings get connected to jobs, and people get connected to jobs. So it's not that the wages get directly connected to the persons. That's the outcome of two processes, how earnings get connected to jobs and how people get connected to jobs. So there are two possible ways of organizing this process. One is to have tons of competition, have everybody in an unregulated way competing for positions and employers being able to adjust wages up and down exactly as they see fit. And the other is to have a set of rules which dampen competition and set standards for the connection between wages and jobs. Okay, those are two processes, two different ways of solving this problem of how do you connect wages to jobs, earnings to jobs. And then I argued that the key process through which inequalities within labor markets have been increasing centers around the intensification of competitiveness, that is, deregulation of labor markets, which leads to increasing inequalities. And I went through a number of aspects of this intensification. of labor markets and how this generates increasing inequality. Perhaps the most obvious is the collapse of the minimum wage. You know, if you have a very low minimum wage, that reduces the wage standards at the bottom of the earnings distribution. The United States' highest minimum wage was in the late 1960s, and since then it's declined because it hasn't kept up with inflation. If the minimum wage had kept up with inflation, I don't have the numbers exactly up to date, but it would be in the vicinity of $20 an hour today. The demand of activists who are trying to raise the minimum wage is just for $15 an hour. $15 an hour would still place this below the late 1960s in inflation-adjusted dollars. Well, what's the explanation for this intensification of competition? Well, there's three sorts of things that are typically pointed to. I think these are all relevant. First is the decline of unions. One of the things that unions do, and one of the reasons why employers don't like unions, is that unions reduce competition among workers. That's part of their strategy. That's part of the way they attempt to increase the job security and the economic security of workers in general, who are members of the union, is by dampening the competition between them, by creating a set of rules which the union imposes through its bargaining with employers on the intensity of competition in the labor market. Now, if you believe that the more competition you have in a society, the better, then clearly unions interfere with competition. They reduce the competition for jobs by creating a set of rules that dampen it. In some parts of the world, Sweden is a good example, for a very long time, unions adopted a wage strategy that they referred to as solidarity wages, a solidarity strategy. That means that when they bargain for wage increases, they always bargain for bigger increases for the least well-paid workers, bigger proportional increases. They argued for a wage bargain that reduced the spread of wages, that actually compressed the wage distribution. That was part of the strategy. And the idea was that if you build a wage structure that's more compressed, you would increase the level of solidarity among workers. They would see themselves as more like each other. And that would increase overall the strength of the labor movement in its bargaining with with the employers. That's a wage compression strategy. Well, that's a pretty extreme version. The United States never really had a wage compression strategy, but it was still the case that when unions were strong, wage inequality was lower than when unions became weak. Secondly, there's a decline of government regulation. The decline of the minimum wage is an example. That's a government regulation, right? So a minimum wage says to employers, you cannot pay less than this amount. It's illegal. But there's lots of other government regulations that affect wages. There's a problem in the United States in some sectors of what's called wage theft. So wage theft on the part of employers are situations in which workers work for 2 weeks, and at the end of the 2 weeks, they're simply not paid what they are owed. The employer just doesn't pay them the full amount that they're owed. That's wage theft. It seems completely, it's illegal. Wage theft is not allowed. But there are kinds of workplaces where employers can get away with it. And in particular, workplaces in which there is a fair proportion of undocumented immigrants, sweatshop labor, employers can get away with it. Because what is the undocumented worker going to do? He's not going to go to, or she's not going to go to court to sue the employer because they risk being deported. Wage theft is a problem in the United States. And wage theft rules have not been enforced. And finally, and I think this shouldn't be minimized, increased global competition has indeed led to a increase in the wage spread because it has helped to keep down wages at the bottom of the labor market for competitive purposes. And finally, some people place a great deal of stress on this. Technological change increases inequality in the labor market. I personally think that technological change is exaggerated as a factor, but it certainly does play some role. Technical change within work has led to a decline in the demand for unskilled labor relative to previous periods, and an increase in the demand of skilled labor, and that has contributed to increasing wage inequality. Well, let me turn to the final part of this. The third source of increasing inequality has to do with wealth inequality. And this is a pretty straightforward kind of problem. It's difficult for the average person to accumulate much wealth through savings. That is, if you are a person that isn't born with wealth, the only way you can accumulate wealth is to accumulate it out of your earnings. And if earnings have been stagnant for the last 40 years at the median, at the middle, it's simply difficult for most people to save very much out of the flow of income that comes to them. Stagnation of household incomes means that discretionary income for most people hasn't grown much. Indeed, the rise of consumer debt in this period as a way of compensating for wage stagnation makes it even harder to save, because you actually have negative savings when you have a net household debt. So when this is combined with stagnation at the middle, is combined with fantastic rise in employment earnings at the high end of the market, this has allowed well-paid professionals and managers to turn their surplus earnings into capitalist wealth by investing in stocks, bonds, real estate, and other assets. The huge increase in wealth inequality is a secondary effect of the increase of income inequality. Since the increase of income inequality is so extraordinary at the very top of the income distribution. And this becomes a kind of vicious cycle of accelerating inequality because of the way in which the accumulation of wealth feeds on itself, because you reinvest the earnings that you get from your accumulated wealth. Well, that's the story from the last lecture. Persistent inequality, persistent poverty, and increasing inequality. The question then is, what can we do about it? Or is there anything we can do about it? Well, let me begin with some clarifications. So now we're starting lecture 15. The first clarification centers around this idea, this term, which has gotten a pretty bad name in the United States in recent decades, the idea of welfare. Welfare is criticized particularly by conservatives, but not only by conservatives. After all, in the 1990s, during the Clinton administration, Bill Clinton proudly declared that he was ending welfare as we know it, as if welfare was intrinsically a bad thing and therefore it ought to be ended. Ending welfare as we know it was the policy change in the middle of the 1990s, which dramatically reduced the availability of cash transfers to poor families and made it much more conditional on a whole set of requirements. But what then really is government welfare? How should we think about it? Here's how I would define it. Government welfare is any government subsidy to a particular group of people, which provides them with an economic benefit that they would not have had if things were just left up to the market. So it's any transfer from the government to help particular kinds of people, groups of people, giving them an economic benefit that they would not have if things were just left up to the market. So Medicaid, the health insurance program for the poor, is certainly welfare, because in the absence of Medicaid, poor people simply could not afford to buy health insurance. It's just too expensive when it's offered on the market, and they simply don't have the resources for it. So Medicaid is a solution to that problem. It's a It's a declaration by the society via the government that no, it's important that even poor people have access to health care, and Medicaid, the health insurance program for the poor, is a way of solving that problem. So that would count as welfare. But there's lots of other kinds of welfare. And we really need a full spectrum understanding of it before we look at the particular parts of the welfare system that are designed to deal with the problem of persistent poverty. So first of all, just to clarify what's going on here, if you define welfare in this general way, a government economic benefit to help people do something that they could not otherwise do if left up to the market. There's two different ways of doing this. First, there's direct government spending, things like food stamps, public housing, cash payments, Medicaid, Medicare. These are all direct government spending to provide such benefits. But there's another strategy which turns out to be extremely important, which are called tax expenditures or tax-directed subsidies, mortgage deductions. If you can deduct the interest payments on a mortgage that you purchase when you purchase a house, that's a government subsidy to help you buy a house, which would be more difficult because the interest payments would be higher in the absence of that deduction. Earned income tax credits for the working poor, tax deductions for business expenses. All of these are ways of transferring income from the government to private persons to enable them to do things. And tax subsidies should be regarded as a particular form of welfare directed at a particular target populations. Well, let's first look at welfare for already privileged social groups. What's an example? What are examples of welfare to already privileged? People who are already in a pretty good position in society, but they get government spending in order to facilitate their lives, to enable them to accomplish and do things that they would otherwise find it more difficult to do. Well, there's one example which applies to nearly all of you, except for those of you, especially foreign students, who are paying full tuition at the University of Wisconsin, and that's tuition subsidies. The in-state tuition at the University of Wisconsin-Madison covers about a third, somewhere between a third and a half of your total, the total costs of educating you. What does that mean? It means that somewhere around half of your education expenses are being paid for out of taxes, probably more. It's a little hard to calculate because you have to partition the total budget of the university into that part which goes to educating students and that part that goes to other things like research. And the difficulty is that a lot of research that's done is also relevant for educating students, so it's not a clean separation. You can see how that's a problem, particularly when it's necessary to spend money on research to recruit the faculty to do the teaching. So it's a little hard to say, well, what's the percentage of your personal cost of being educated is covered by your tuition. But the usual estimates are somewhere in the vicinity of a third to a half. That means you're all recipients of welfare. You might not have known it, but you are. Even foreign students get a little bit of welfare, not nearly as much, because in fact, even full tuition here doesn't actually probably cover 100% of the costs of being educated. Homeowners, that's a very big one, the mortgage deduction. 48% of mortgage subsidies go to the top 20% of the income distribution. You know, just about half of all the tax transfers to homeowners to make it easier for them to own a home by giving them a deduction on their income tax for the interest on their mortgages, about half of that goes to the top 20% of the income distribution. And mortgage subsidies are more than four times the total spending on public housing for the poor. Well, we have welfare for the affluent that's four times higher than welfare for the poor with respect to the problem of housing. Now, you can think this is a good or bad thing. The mortgage deduction is arguably a good thing, because it's probably a good thing for the health of our communities and cities to have people owning their own homes. You know, there's certainly good reasons to think that home ownership is a desirable feature of a community's life. Rather than having cities made up and towns made up primarily of people renting from landlords, to have it primarily people who own their own homes, well, there are good arguments for that. I mean, there's arguments against it. There's, you know, there are trade-offs, like in everything. But we could say, yes, this is good public policy. We do want to encourage people, make it easier for people to own homes. But if we believe that, and there are some people that are simply too poor to, even with the mortgage subsidy, be able to own their own home, it does seem a little odd to say we will make all these subsidies available to affluent people and be really miserly in how we spend to provide housing services for people who can't afford to buy homes. One of the reasons why we have a serious homeless problem in the United States is precisely because of the unwillingness to spend money on public housing, on housing services. By public housing, I don't mean giant apartment blocks that are owned by a city. I just mean public support for the housing of people who can't afford to buy homes. And the homeless problem is public support for the housing of people who can't afford the rents, given the rental markets. That would count as welfare, but no more so than the welfare given to homeowners. Farm subsidies. About $30 billion a year in the United States goes to farmers, and 80% of that goes to corporate agriculture, not family farmers. Farm subsidies are generally defended on the grounds that this is important to sustain the family farm, and the family farm, there's a kind of both a practical and a romantic attachment to family farming as a form of agriculture. And again, I think it's perfectly good public policy to try to support family farmers, to make it easier for people to sustain that particular way of life. And that probably does require subsidies for various reasons. I am much more ambivalent about the subsidies that go to corporate agriculture, to agribusiness, which make high rates of profit and capture the vast majority of the government welfare to farmers. But again, that's welfare for the privileged. And finally, there's what is often called corporate welfare. This is welfare that goes to corporations, comes to about $75 billion a year or so. Here's a bunch of examples. I won't go through them. They're discussed in the book, and they're also available on the slide. These are all examples of corporate welfare that comes from the conservative Cato Institute's Handbook for Congress. The Cato Institute, as a libertarian institute, is equally opposed to corporate welfare as it is to welfare for the poor. They just want to get rid of all of it. They want to get rid of all government subsidies to all target populations, whether they be rich or poor. They want to get rid of the homeowner's mortgage deduction. Their feeling is the market should decide whether you can buy a house or not. It shouldn't be up to the government to help you buy a house. They're against Medicaid. The government shouldn't be providing health care for the poor. That should be done through charity. They're not in favor of poor people not having health care. They just don't think it's a collective responsibility. It's a responsibility of benevolent persons to through charity to provide such health care, and so on. But they are dead against government welfare for corporations. Now, it might surprise you a little, perhaps. I'm not particularly against what's called corporate welfare. I think it's a case-by-case basis. For example, I think that the government subsidies for energy transition from fossil fuels to wind is probably a good thing. There was a nice little piece on NPR last night about Rick Perry as governor of Texas, who provided huge subsidies for wind farming, for the development of wind turbines in West Texas. Texas is now the leading producer of wind energy in the United States. Now, he did it not because of any commitment to environmental protection, to a transition from fossil fuels, but he saw that this was a place where if you provided the government subsidies, there could be a sector that would grow very rapidly, and in which people could make a lot of money, and he thought that was a good thing. And he was probably right. I think right for maybe the wrong reasons. I think that the reason to subsidize wind energy is because it's a very effective alternative to fossil fuels, and West Texas is a fantastic place to do it because it's windy and flat. So you put up a wind turbine and you get electricity from it all the time. But it required substantial public investment and thus subsidy to that sector in order to get the transmission lines from the wind turbines into the grid of the Texas electric system. So I'm in favor of quite a lot of corporate welfare. I think it's probably well spent money to direct investment in particular ways, to encourage different kinds of sectors, to underwrite small business, to encourage advanced technologies in various ways. These are good things. We need that kind of welfare. We need tax subsidies and direct grants to encourage economic development in particular ways. But the justification for it, I think, is such that it implies that the generic indictment of welfare, when it's only indicted for the poor, is simply inconsistent. We need welfare for the poor because we need to interfere with the way the market treats people. And we need welfare for the rich because we need to encourage them to do certain things. And we need welfare for students because higher education would be simply too expensive for many of you if you could not get the subsidy. And higher education is a good thing. It's a good thing for your lives, and it's a good thing for the society that you be educated. And that requires resources, and it's perfectly appropriate to use public resources for it. Welfare for the rich is justifiable sometimes. Welfare for the middle class is often justified, as is welfare for the poor. All right, that's just taking care of kind of the ideological baggage, if you will, that's connected to the idea of welfare. Just treat it as a way of solving problems by allocating public resources to correct failures in the way markets would solve the problem. Markets by themselves, just left to their own devices, are going to be too slow in developing wind energy. So subsidies are needed, welfare for corporations. Markets, if left to their own devices, will destroy family farms even more rapidly than has happened. Let's figure out a subsidy situation. Now, in that particular case, the subsidies have gotten completely screwy because of lobbying, and the subsidies for farming end up being subsidies for corporate agriculture much more than for family farms. But the principle is still a good one. Let's subsidize students so you can get a good education. Let's solve the problem of that the market, if left to its own devices, produces persistent poverty by finding good public policy solutions to it. Well, what are the kinds of solutions to poverty? I'm going to explore three sorts of structural approaches. Again, these are not alternatives in the sense that you have to pick one and not others. These are three different strategies for tackling the problem. All of them are important. The first one is partially decouple the standards of living of people from market earnings. This involves an idea that we can call a social wage. Think of it this way. Everybody's standard of living comes from two kinds of wages. One is your private wage. That's what you earn when you get a job, right? So you get paid a certain amount. But there's another component of your standard of living, which isn't paid to you individually, but nevertheless is a component of how well you live. And we can call that the social wage. It's the part of your standard of living that comes from the public provision of various elements of your standard of living without charging you. This includes a lot of things. And Madison is an interesting case. The zoo in Madison, Vilas Zoo in Vilas Park, is a free zoo. That's pretty unusual. Most zoos in the United States, you have to pay to get in. Madison has this very cute, I think, charming little zoo. If you have any taste for zoos, I do recommend you saunter into Vilas Zoo at some point while you're here. It's walking distance from campus. It's a very charming small zoo, and it becomes integrated into the life of the neighborhood a lot. I live close by, but also to people who go to Vilas Park, which is a very big park for all sorts of recreational activities. If you go to the park, you'll spend 10 or 15 minutes in the zoo, perhaps. It's free. What that means is, it's a small component of people's standard of living, but it is part of your standard of living, to live in a place where you have free access to a zoo. Recreation in general, we can think of that way. Some cities have good public recreational facilities that are provided free for people. Others do not. You have to join a private country club in order to get access to a swimming pool. It used to be like that in Madison, actually. Because we have lakes, there was opposition for a long time, you know, much longer than you might think for such a liberal environment, to spending city money to build a public swimming pool, because after all, the lakes were free. But finally, it was realized that this disadvantaged poor children because it made it harder for them to get swimming lessons. It's kind of hard if you've been in any of the Madison lakes in the summer, you'll realize it's not the ideal environment for a swimming class because of the weeds and algae and other things you have to contend with when you're swimming in it. But public libraries, swimming pools, parks, subsidized daycare, universal health care, these are all components of your standard of living. And one strategy for dealing with the problem of poverty is to simply make more of the components of your standard of living accessible without paying for it. That means that if you're money poor, you're less poor than you would otherwise be. You could be money poor, but actually live better if you're living in an environment with lots of these freely accessible public goods. If you recall from the discussion of transportation a few weeks ago, I argued for the desirability of free public transportation on a whole variety of grounds. You know, there's lots of reasons for it. But one of the reasons is that it makes mobility in the city free for everybody. And that's raising the standards of living of poor people. The imperative that they own a car in many cities would be way lower. Wouldn't disappear entirely. There's still reasons why people would want private cars, but it becomes less of an imperative and less of a necessary component of their standard of living if you had free public transportation. So that's the first strategy. That's not usually included when you see discussions of how to solve the problem of poverty in the United States, how to reduce it. It's not standard part of the discussion to point out, well, one thing we can do is stop reducing, certainly. We've been reducing these free public goods, the social wage over time. Let's expand the social wage. Second element is, well, let's partially decouple paid employment from capitalist markets. I alluded to that in the last lecture when I pointed out that if you have a mismatch between the distribution of skills in a population and the distribution of job demands that the market is generating, you can either say, aha, what we need to do is educate everybody more to bring them up to the standards to fill the jobs that are available, or you can say, in addition to the skill upgrading issue, you can say, are there jobs that need to be done which may not be offered in the market because they may not be profitable, but they still need to be done. They're still meeting social needs. They're not just make work. You know, they're not just creating public jobs to dig holes in the ground and fill them up, right? Completely stupid jobs that have no point. No, there's lots of things that need to be done that don't actually require high levels of education. You don't need a university degree to do lots of things that would be very beneficial to the society. And if the market doesn't provide for the creation of those jobs, well, then the public sector ought to do it. The idea of having a public sector playing a positive role in solving problems to meet needs that aren't being met by the market should include, I think, providing jobs to do those things that meet those needs that aren't provided by the market. In the 1930s, in the height of the Depression, the American government created a series of public works programs, basically creating jobs that didn't require a lot of skills. And one of them was something called the Civilian Conservation Corps, the CCC. What the CCC did was take unemployed young people in their 20s mostly, but sometimes older, and they essentially built the national park system's trails and lodges and camping sites. If you go to Yosemite or Yellowstone and walk those trails, many of those trails were built in the 1930s as public sector work. Now, they built a crucial part of our environmental infrastructure, the infrastructure that people continue to enjoy 80 years later, was built under those conditions. That is, there was a situation where there was a big mismatch between the kinds of jobs being generated by the market. The market wasn't going to generate jobs to build trails in the wilderness because you can't make a profit out of it. Because you don't own the land. You can't charge admission to the trails that you build to recoup the costs of building them. But the public can do that because we can say, as a community, through our democratic institutions, we can say, no, this is a good thing. We want to have these areas easily accessible to people with differing physical capacities and differing desires to rough it. You know, to forge their way through the mountains without trails versus having a nicely graded trail with steps in particular places. And if you go to national parks, the old national parks, the ones that have been around for, you know, 80 years, lots of the trails you're going to go on and campsites you're going to stay in were actually built by public sector workers under the Civilian Conservation Corps. Well, so the idea of public sector jobs as a solution to poverty says we have this problem of people who can't find jobs of a stable and good paying variety. You know, they can only find really unstable, insecure, high risk jobs because of their skill level or other problems they may face because of the nature of their communities. Let's just create them. And let's be sure that they do important things. Let's not create make work, let's create real work. And let's pay it at a standard that kind of anchors the wage structure. This is the standard for a minimum job with minimum skills that's doing something worthwhile. That is, let's ensure that all jobs created in the public sector, these kind of public sector jobs, create living wages. Some people like to describe this strategy as that the government should be an employer of last resort. You'll hear that expression, the employer of last resort. Last resort. That implies that there's something better, more real, more valuable about jobs created in the market than jobs created by the state, by us as a collectivity deciding about things that need to be done. I think that is an incorrect way of understanding the problem. The better way of understanding the problem is this. There's a lot of things that need to be done that will improve the quality of life of people. Some of those things are better done by the state. They'll be done better, more effectively, more efficiently, with better quality jobs for the people that do them than if they are left up to the market. And some things will just never get done by the market. So let's figure out. Let's treat it as a problem to be solved. What sort of things do we want public sector jobs to do? And then let's fund them properly. Rather than, let's let the market decide what the job structure is, and then as a last resort, let's see if we can find something for people to do, perhaps through public sector employment. The public sector should be regarded as a positive constituent element of an economic structure, not as a residual. How large it is depends upon the needs of the society, not on some a priori judgment that the government which governs best governs least, and we want as small a public sector as possible. No, we should treat this as a problem to be solved, and then allocate resources accordingly, which means having taxes sufficient to pay for those public sector, that public sector work. This is not a recipe for a minimum tax regime, of course. It says that, and we're going to have a whole class on taxes and how to think about them. It's not a recipe for a minimum tax regime. It's a recipe for allocating our resources in a way that best serves society as a whole. So that's the second basic strategy. Second strategy. If you want to deal with poverty, first strategy, raise people's standards of living a little bit at least by creating more public goods, the social wage. Second strategy, let's have a real public sector that actually is an employment sector, not of last resort, but an employment sector to do things that need to be done. The third strategy is to partially decouple income from earnings. So the first strategy was to decouple standards of living from earnings by making some things free, public libraries. The third strategy is to decouple income from earnings. And we already have some examples of how there's efforts to think through ways of doing that. There is, for example, some experiments that have been done in what are called asset development accounts. Asset development accounts. This was quite popular as an anti-poverty idea in the 1990s. I think it's declined. I haven't seen as much reference to this, but it still has some traction. The Ford Foundation funded a very big experiment in this. And the basic idea was this, that for people who have limited income, it nevertheless would be good for them to accumulate assets, for them to have some wealth, to have savings. Savings are important, really, for everyone. But how do you get people with limited assets, to limited income to save? Well, what the Ford Foundation did was ran an experiment where they would match the savings of people in the experiment, sometimes tripling it. For every dollar you put in your savings account, we will add $2 or $3. They had, they experimented with different levels of matching, and those savings could be used only for specific purposes. So you would they would be savings accounts which would accumulate interest, but could only be used for certain purposes. You can't just use them for ordinary consumption. Well, it turned out that with that level of incentive, pretty big incentive, $2 for every dollar you put in, pretty big incentive for you to save. Even very poor people were able to put away a few dollars a week once they had an incentive to do so, once they could see that that would actually generate a cumulative effect of earnings. The experiment was considered very successful in terms of actually creating a safety net that was a more personal safety net, part of the individual assets that people would accumulate. Now, to be done on a large scale, of course, you can't expect that to be done by private foundations. They did it as an experiment to show that it would actually encourage and underwrite fairly rapid savings expansion among otherwise very poor communities in order for that to actually be done at scale, to change the distribution of wealth in the society by bringing up the wealth assets at the bottom, it would have to be supported by public funds. There's no way that that could be done on a large scale privately. But there's another idea which I want to explain to you, which is much more controversial, but which is getting a fair amount of discussion these days. You know, you may have heard of this yourself now in the news. It's been in the news recently, and I predict it's going to increasingly be in the news over the next decade or so. And it's called unconditional basic income. Unconditional basic income. Let me give you the principles here. So this is a proposal. It's being actively debated in some parts of the world. There's a proposal in Finland, for example, to try out an unconditional basic income in the course of the next few years. It's an official part of the party program of one of the presidential candidates in France. It's for the first time an official part of the program. There are a variety of places in Europe that are giving it serious attention. There's an experiment going on in unconditional basic income, I believe in the city of Utrecht in the Netherlands. In some city in the Netherlands, they're trying it out. So here's the basic idea. Central principles. First, it's a basic income. It provides for a decent, no-frills standard of living above the poverty line for everyone. So it's a kind of a shmoo, right? Remember the shmoo? Giving everybody a shmoo-like income. No frills, but it provides for all of your basic needs at just above the poverty line. It's universal, it's given to everybody. It's given to the richest as well as the poorest person. Bill Gates gets a basic income along with all of you. Anyone who's a legal resident of a polity, of a community, gets it, rich and poor, and it's unconditional. There are no restrictions, no work requirements, and no moral test. You don't have to pass a drug test to get your basic income. You can be an ex-felon. You don't have to be a good person. No virtue tests. It's unconditional. It's a bit like Medicare, right? Medicare is an unconditional, universal benefit given to everybody who is a legal resident in the United States. You can be a green card holder and get Medicare. Anybody who's a legal resident in the United States can get Medicare. It's an unconditional benefit of health services for the elderly. You don't have to be a good person. You get it whether you're a smoker or a not smoker. You don't have to have lived a healthy life. It's an unconditional grant of health services. Well, unconditional basic income is a cash version of that, and it's given to everyone. Well, this seems like a really extravagant idea. Let me explain how it works and draw a contrast so that you'll see what's in play about it. Unconditional basic income should be understood in the context of a contrast between two kinds of programs for providing benefits to people. These are called means-tested versus universal programs. Means-tested versus universal. A means-tested program means a person only gets a benefit if they fall below some level of income. So you have to satisfy that test. You're below a level, then you get the benefit. Food stamps are an example. A universal program is everybody gets the benefit regardless of income. And examples? Public education and Medicare. Tuition at the University of Wisconsin is not means tested. It's not the case that if your income is above a certain amount, you have to pay full tuition. You pay a third of the full tuition. Full tuition meaning tuition sufficient to cover the cost of education. So just imagine if you had a means tested tuition system where how much you paid for a university depended upon your earnings, your family's earnings. If you were rich, you'd pay $25,000 or $30,000 a year to come to the University of Wisconsin. If you were middle class, you'd pay $15,000 or $20,000 a year. If you were poor, you'd pay $8,000 or $10,000 a year. That's a very different way of allocating the expenses. Now, maybe it's a good idea. You know, you can think of justifications for having a means-tested university tuition. You can imagine that public support among middle and upper income people for the University of Wisconsin might decline if they were charged more for it. They would see this less as a universal benefit than as a specific benefit for, as a benefit for everyone. That's part of the problem of means-tested programs. Let me just explain. This is the result of a lot of social science research about the consequences of means-tested programs. One is stigma. Recipients are labeled negatively. This is something you may not know, but in welfare programs, so standard cash transfer welfare programs are means-tested in the United States, like food stamps. You have to go to a welfare office and register as a food stamp recipient in order to get food stamps. The result of the stigma that's attached to it, that is the negative labeling and social status that comes with being a food stamp recipient, the result of that is that a very high proportion of the people who are eligible for food stamps don't apply for it. They feel it's shameful. They feel embarrassed about it. They don't want to be seen in public being a food stamp recipient. The stigma used to be greater because it used to be, as the name food stamps suggests, actual food stamps. You had little vouchers you handed in instead of cash. Now the food stamp program takes the form of a credit card type thing, a piece of plastic. It's a little less obvious when you go to the cashier that you're paying with a food stamp. Less obvious to other people. They won't see that that's what you're doing. On the other hand, you can only buy certain kinds of food with food stamps, and if your shopping basket is mixed, then you pay for part of it with the plastic and part of it you have to pay separately. It signals to the world that you are poor, that you're below that criterion. Stigma is a very big deal in welfare systems by design, and some welfare programs are meant to make the recipients feel inferior and stigmatized. It's one of the ways of keeping the costs down. If you can reduce the proportion of people who are eligible to sign up for it, the program is less expensive. Stigma is an important issue, and that's one of the problems with means-tested programs. Means-tested programs also tend to have a weak basis of public support. Universal programs build bridges across groups. Means-tested programs create cleavages between groups. You know, you see this in the way in which seniors defend Medicare. You know, Medicare is viewed as a right of everybody, and it brings all seniors together into a kind of coalition to defend this benefit that is not means-tested. It's universal for everybody over the age of 65. On the other hand, Medicaid is a program only for the poor. And it divides people. Why should I be paying taxes for those people? I don't receive any benefit. Medicaid divides people, Medicare unites people. And this is a general aspect of universal programs. They tend to provide more social cohesion. A public education used to be like that. Somewhat less today because of the proportion of the population that have chosen to exit public education for various forms of private education, and then they resent the fact that they're having to pay taxes for public education, which they're not using. Universal programs become rights. Means-tested programs are viewed as charity, publicly paid charity. Rights, universal programs become rights. Those are called entitlements. You're entitled to it. One of the reasons why conservatives dislike entitlements is precisely because they are entitlements. People come to believe they are rights, and rights are something they wish to defend. In the fights over the Obama healthcare programs in 2010, there was this very weird set of protests against it by senior citizens who would hold up placards saying, "Keep the government off of my Medicare." You know, they saw Obamacare as a threat to the funding of Medicare because it would increase government spending on healthcare. But they somehow had this idea that Medicare wasn't itself a government program. Keep the government hands off my Medicare. You know, and that's because it was seen as an entitlement. It was seen as a right, as a citizen, that you got Medicare when you were over 65, just like Social Security. It's been very hard for conservatives to privatize Social Security, which is one of the things that the Republican Party would like to do, that they've said they'd like to do. I mean, I'm not attributing some nefarious motive. This is what is part of the public policy advocacy of conservatives. They would rather turn Social Security from a guaranteed benefit that you receive in old age to prevent you from going into poverty to an investment plan, that you invest your Social Security payments in the stock market over the years, and then if the stock market crashes, tough luck. You're out of your investment. Turning Social Security into an investment plan means it's no longer Social Security. It's just an investment vehicle. Seniors have opposed the private, that's called the privatization of Social Security. Senior citizens, the AARP, other organizations of seniors have opposed privatization of Social Security because it's a right and it's a universal program and it's seen as part of the way in which you reduce risk in life. And that's something that comes with universal programs. The result of all this is that universal programs usually do more to help the poor than means-tested programs. There's a slogan in the poverty research community which says, programs directed at the poor are usually poor programs. Universal programs actually help the poor more than targeted programs. That seems a little bit counterintuitive. If we have a certain amount of money and we want to use it for anti-poverty programs purposes, doesn't it make more sense to allocate all of that money to poor people? An unconditional basic grant, income grant has this weird property. We're giving everybody a basic income, whether you need it or not. You get it. Wow, that seems like an inefficient way of allocating resources if really what you want to do is to eliminate poverty. Give everybody a grant in order to eliminate poverty? Why not just give the money to the people who are poor by having a means test? Well, that's a counterintuitive point, but it has to do with the nature of the solidarities and cohesion and conflict that gets generated by different kinds of programs. Make it universal, it becomes seen as a right, a broader coalition of people will want to defend it. Well, how does this work? How does it work? Well, first of all, one thing to note, it is paid for by taxes. You know, it's not a shmoo. You know, the shmoo is a mutation of a wild turkey in the mountains of the Ozarks. Unfortunately, we don't have shmoos. The only way to actually give everybody a basic income is to raise taxes. The taxes on Bill Gates will be raised by way more than the basic income. So Bill Gates will not, in fact, be a net recipient of basic income. The way it would work is Bill Gates would get his $12,000 a year, $15,000 a year, whatever the basic income is. You know, there's some uncertainty as to how high it could be, but let's for the moment just say it's $15,000 a year, maybe a bit less. The Finnish proposal, I think, for a basic, or the French proposal for a basic income is at 12,000 euros a year, 1,000 euros a month. And 12,000 euros a year, I think, is around $14,000, $15,000 a year. So let's just say, for argument's sake, $15,000 a year. Bill Gates would get his $15,000 a year, and his taxes would probably go up by $500,000 a year. You know, he won't notice the difference in his discretionary income because his discretionary income is in the tens of millions of dollars a year or more, but his he'll be paying way more taxes. So he will be a net contributor, not a net recipient. Some people will have their taxes raised $15,000 a year and they'll get a basic income, $15,000 a year. So it's a wash. They'll be right at the cut point. And some people will get $15,000 a year and their taxes will increase by $13,000 a year. So they'll receive a net benefit of $2,000. So you see how it works. It's a smooth transition, right? There's no break point that is unambiguous. And many people, some years will be net beneficiaries and some years net contributors. You'll go back and forth across that barrier. It's a smooth transition. This is very different from means-tested programs. That's one of the problems of means-tested programs. This is called a poverty trap with a means-tested program. So if you only get food stamps, if your income falls below the poverty line, and you get a job that puts you $100 above the poverty line, you lose your food stamps. Well, you then ask yourself, I lost this benefit of food stamps, which is very valuable. And I had a job that was below the poverty line. Maybe I shouldn't accept the wage increase. I shouldn't accept the promotion that kicks me over the poverty line because I lose my benefits. That's the problem. That's called a poverty trap, that it's actually beneficial to stay in poverty because of the benefits than it is to earn a little bit more that begins to pull you out of poverty. Well, basic income doesn't have that problem because it's a completely smooth trade-off. Okay, how does it work? Well, what are some, first of all talk about some of the potential positive consequences. First, straight off, it eliminates extreme poverty without stigma. No stigma because everybody gets it. You just get a check in the mail or a wire transfer to a saving, you know, to a savings account. You get rid of extreme poverty. You don't have to sign up for it. There's no stigma. Second, it facilitates all sorts of non-market activity in the arts, caregiving, community activism. Think about the arts. As I think I might have mentioned, I have a daughter who's a theater director, has an interesting small theater company in Philadelphia. She is a very big fan of the idea of basic income, as you can imagine, not just for herself, but for the whole arts community, the whole performing arts community. It makes it possible for people to say, yes, I'm perfectly happy living at a no-frills basic standard of living, because that frees me to engage in my artistic passions. Basic income also provides a sense of better targeted subsidy for small farmers. That's a kind of strange thing. Just imagine, let's get rid of all farm subsidies. Agribusiness doesn't get it anymore, but small farmers don't get it anymore either. But let's have a basic income. Well, what does that mean? It means that a small farm family now knows that their basic needs are guaranteed independently of how well the farm does in that year. They get all of their basic needs paid for through the basic income. What the farm then is doing is generating discretionary income. The farm is still generating income. They produce things and sell it on the market. But what the farm is doing is generating income above the basic income. That stabilizes small farming. It makes it way easier to be a small farm, to avoid taking on debt as a small farmer in order to expand to the point where you can generate enough income for the family to live. It means that small farmers don't have to have one family member working in a factory or working in the city in order to bring in a flow of steady and predictable income. So basic income as this quality of providing ways of life for both, if you will, theater artists and farmers, a strange political coalition of urban and rural people who have distinctive ways of life that are difficult to pursue if all of their income has to be generated by conventional labor market and market processes. It also provides a way of facilitating caregiving activities. Feminists in some countries, in the Netherlands, for example, have been supporters of basic income on the grounds that it's kind of like wages for parenting. You know, it's kind of like providing a guaranteed income for people who are taking care of children and the elderly outside of market relations. It's validating that as productive, important work without the cumbersome mechanisms of having you have to register as a registered caregiver and having somebody monitor your activities to be sure you're doing it. So that's a second potential consequence of basic income grants. It gives everybody the possibility of engaging in non-market activity. Third, it gives everybody a measure of real freedom. Remember from our discussion earlier in the semester where we drew this distinction between positive and negative freedom. And I talked about real freedom or positive freedom as the freedom to actually put your plans, life plans into practice, to actually do and live the life you want to live, as opposed to negative freedom, which is just the ability to avoid being bossed around, have somebody tell you what to do. One way of thinking about basic income is that it's a universal freedom grant. It gives everybody a basic grant of freedom. It makes it perhaps a little bit more attractive to some ways of thinking if you think of it as a liberty grant for everybody, rather than just as a consumption grant, money for consumption. It's money to live your life the way you want. But it also strengthens negative freedom because it makes it easier to say no. Negative freedom is one way of thinking about it, is it's the ability to say no. Unconditional basic income makes it easier to say no, makes it easier to quit a job because not all of your income is at stake when you quit a job. It makes it easier to exit an abusive relationship because your standard of living is less contingent upon staying together. And finally, unconditional basic income puts pressure on employers to innovate to eliminate unpleasant, boring work, because lousy work, really unpleasant work, becomes more expensive. That's an interesting feature of an unconditional basic income. Many people are going to still want to work, right? So it's not that an unconditional basic income means you're not going to want to work, because most people will want some discretionary income. However, really crappy work, unpleasant work, boring work becomes more expensive because people have options. They can say no. Unconditional basic income puts pressure on employers for technological innovation to get rid of boring, tedious, unpleasant work. These are all pretty desirable consequences, I think. But of course, there are objections to basic income. Now, one objection is the simple moral objection. It's a bad idea because people just shouldn't have unconditionally their basic standard of living guaranteed. You know, some people just find that inherently objectionable. And I can understand where the objection lies in. It's a, you know, after all, the resources that are generated to pay the basic income come from people who work. That's just the facts of the matter. People have to work in order to generate the income that gets taxed to provide the basic income. Well, why should I work to let somebody be a surfer? You know, to be a beach bum? The lack of reciprocity, that violates some important moral principles. And so there is a moral objection to basic income. Even if you acknowledge all of these desirable features, getting rid of poverty, increasing freedom, expanding the arts, subsidizing farmers without subsidizing agribusiness. You know, even if you agree with all that, you can still say, I oppose it, because reciprocity is too important. And we shouldn't have hardworking people provide income for beach bums. But there are also pragmatic arguments against basic income. Remember, pragmatic arguments are just arguments of the form, it just won't work. So for example, too many people will stop working for pay, and thus not enough income will be generated to sustain the system. Suppose that everybody's deepest desire is to be a couch potato and to watch Netflix series all day long. You know, the temptation to be a couch potato has increased with the proliferation of these bingeable series on stream television. Well, maybe that's really part of human nature, that we're lazy at heart, and that's the kind of lives that most people would live. Well, it's certainly true that if it's the case that the vast majority of people, or even the majority of people, perhaps, decide they would rather not work for pay and live at the level of the basic income and spend all their time watching television, using that as a kind of placeholder for not contributing anything, the system would collapse. So one unknown question is, what percentage of the labor force, in fact, in equilibrium, you know, when everything sets down and people really understand how this thing works, what percentage of the labor force really wants to do nothing? That's an issue. And the second issue is the taxes to pay for big will be so high that there will be huge disincentives to work. Well, the second objection you can show is incorrect, because the tax increases needed to fund even a generous basic income are not that great. It's much less than you think, because after all, remember, a basic income replaces all the other kinds of income transfer programs. You don't need unemployment insurance. You don't need welfare for the poor, targeted programs. A whole range of programs get eliminated because you have an unconditional basic income. And furthermore, unconditional basic income is super cheap to administer. It's a really cheap program because it's just given to everybody. You don't have to monitor people's behavior. You don't have to have a surveillance system connected to it that is expensive. The estimates for what it would cost in the United States are such that it wouldn't even close the gap between the American overall tax rates and the average tax rates of rich countries. We still would be just below the average tax rate if we raised taxes sufficiently to pay for an unconditional basic income. So the tax objection, I don't think, has any force. The question of what the incentives to work will be and how people will behave, that is a real issue. We don't know the answer to that question. That's a question that can only be answered when experiments in basic income are tried. All right, it's 12:15. I'll see you next week.